Thank you, everybody, for being here this afternoon. My name is Ted Nickel, Commissioner of Insurance for the state of Wisconsin, also NEIC Secretary Treasurer. And I just want to thank the folks at CIPR for having me, allowing me to moderate our first panel for the day. And looking forward to a great discussion from some folks with a lot of great insights on this very important subject of captives. And what we're basically going to kind of get into is the meat of their perspectives. And again, it's a wide variety and a really great panel of different perspectives on the use of captives, the origination of captives, and the future of captives in the insurance marketplace in the U.S. and beyond. So with that as a really brief introduction, I want to just quickly go through and introduce the members of the panel today. Our first panelist, David Provost, is a Deputy Commissioner of Vermont's Captive Insurance Division, where he oversees regulation of captive insurance companies and risk retention groups. Mr. Provost has over 25 years of experience in captive insurance, both in the private and government sectors. Our next panelist is William Pargins, Assistant Vice President of AM Best Life and Health Ratings Division. Mr. Pargins manages a team of analysts and has responsibility for ratings and analysis of a portfolio of domestic and life insurance companies followed by AM Best. Also serving on the panel today is Alan Rothenstein. Rothenstein, a principal and consulting actuary with the New York office of Milliman. Since joining Milliman in 2008, he has consulted extensively to insurance companies on XXX, AXXX reserve financing, embedded value securitization transactions, and other life insurance captive transactions. Our final panelist is Neil Rector, founder of and senior consultant of Rector and Associates Incorporated. The firm provides a wide variety of services nationally to the insurance industry clients and to regulators, including the development of a regulatory framework relative to XXX, AXXX reinsurance transactions, which resulted in Actuarial Guideline 48, which was mentioned earlier. Mr. Rector is also a team leader under the NEIC Accreditation Program. So with that, let's jump into the topic of the discussion for the panel. Again, regulatory and market development of captives. So I want to begin first with David and Alan, and just offer up a brief opening question to get your response. What prompted the life companies to enter the captive market?
We did an arm wrestle over who got this one.
You're welcome.
Okay. All right. This started in 2001, in February 2001, which was before I started with the department, so I'm pretty sure it's not my fault. I won't take credit for it.
David, could you pull it just a little bit closer?
It was on. There we go. So this started in 2001 with the passage of XXX, Actuarial Guideline XXX, which was not my fault. I didn't start until August of 2001. Before that, I was with AIG. And the essence of it was that folks found that the rules for reserves for life insurance companies for certain products were vastly too conservative, to the point of, if you look at some of the comparisons between what the insurance companies feel is the economic reserve or what they really need to have to satisfy their policy obligations compared to what the statutory reserve requirements were, it's 2 to 4 to 5 to 6 times what the expectations are, and that creates a big capital cost for the insurance companies when they're providing that policy. So that led to capital companies seeking capital relief and starting with securitizations, primarily offshore, and then working their way into onshore captives in South Carolina and Vermont and DC and a few other domiciles, and to where we are now.
I'll add a little bit to that. You'll bear with me, please. I'm fighting some severe allergies, so my voice is a little scratchy. The reason why, in addition to the fact that there was a lot of redundancy in the statutory reserves, that term life was a natural first kind of policy to try to securitize, is because the cash flows are quite predictable for term life, and so it was easy to, easier than for many other kinds of policies to structure a transaction with predictable cash flows for investors or other financing providers to take risk on. Another reason is that if you take a step back and you think about who really makes decisions with regard to these kinds of transactions, it really falls on, in my view, usually the CFO of an insurance group. And a CFO or CFOs of insurance groups have historically used, especially for public insurance groups, have used holding company issuance of debt, equity, and hybrid financing as capital management tools to balance the competing interests of various stakeholders, policyholders, shareholders, debt holders. And when they were faced with this challenge of Regulation XXX and the actuaries starting to do some projections and realizing that their RBC ratios were going to decline with time if they just continue the same sales that they have been issuing for the last few years. So in CFOs, chief actuaries, the reinsurers, and investment banks were brainstorming on different ideas on what could possibly work, and it was sort of a natural, in particular, for the public insurance groups to be the first candidates to consider the use of captives as a new form of hybrid financing. That's really one way to look at it, is that it's in many respects very equivalent to the holdco issuing some form of hybrid financing.
I agree with everything that was said. Am I gone?
Could you just pull it a bit closer, Bill?
I've been doing this with AM Best for over 20 years, so I've seen the evolution of captives. Today, and we'll get into it a little later in the program, there's all types of structures and different types of financing. Earlier on, the risks were passed on to the capital markets. And the challenge was, back in 2000, to convince investors that, yes, they're taking tail mortality, but that risk is very, very remote, that they would not get paid on the securities that were backing the XXX reserves. But it took time for the capital markets to embrace this, and that's when the captives started to gain more traction, when it was easier for securities to be issued in support of those reserves.
All right, my second question, back to David. As a captive state, could you describe what AXXX captives were presented to you and how you determined if a captive structure made sense? The interaction you had with the seeding company states and how you made them feel comfortable with these various transactions.
Sure. Thanks. By the time I got involved with these, most of the transactions involved securitizing or providing relief by use of a letter of credit. So the seeding companies would either have a funds withheld or other balances to support the economic reserves plus a cushion, and then a letter of credit in a captive to provide to cover the excess. So that's pretty simple, but we were provided with, on occasion we would have a flow chart that looked more like an octopus of all the conditions, all sorts of problems, and by then I've got ADD and my eyes glaze over and I just say, stop, this isn't gonna work. If I can't explain it to my mother, it ain't happening in Vermont. So that's sort of the mom rule that we had, and I guess Einstein says the same thing. If you can't explain it, you don't understand it. So if I couldn't understand it well enough to really get my hands around it and explain it to somebody else, namely my commissioner upstairs, we made companies simplify things. We wanted a nice straight line from the seeding company to the captive to the risk taker, whether that was a financial institution or a reinsurance company or whatever. It needed to be clear and cut and dried, and able to be reviewed by our in-house attorneys and everybody else to get comfortable with what was going on and be able to understand it. So, you know, on occasion things got a little too complicated, we'd just say, you know, it's got to be a few colors in the crayon box, it can't be all of them, and there can't be a lot of dotted lines here and there, it's just got to be straight. And so when we talked with seeding state regulators, usually that was after the seeding company had already talked to them. So one of the things that we did was make sure that the seeding company gave you the same story they gave us, because that's, you know, just got to make sure everybody's getting the same story. And that's the same for the rating agency as well. Everybody's got to be on the same, have the same understanding of how this is going to work or it's not going to work. And so beyond that, our discussions with the seeding state regulators would always be about what our processes were, what our review process was, what our subsequent regulatory processes were, what our surveillance and examinations were, and how we got comfortable that the letter of credit or whatever the financing was a good solid asset in our view. We also talked a lot about where you draw that line between economic reserves and excess. You know, the seeding company seeds the entire reserve to the captive, and it's just a matter of drawing the line where do you hold cash and investments and other normal assets, and where do you have an alternative asset to support the reserve. So that would be something that we would all have our own independent actuaries review to make sure that they were comfortable with the assumptions, where that line was being drawn, and so that we all got on the same table as far as where this captive was going and how it was being designed.
Well said, David. I know as a fellow regulator, understanding how those lines are being drawn back and forth and making it as clear as possible is very helpful to you as well as to other regulators who might be involved in the transaction one way or the other. I would assume also that for the rating agencies, Bill, it was probably helpful as well. When they're involved in the impact, when you guys are involved in the impact on these transactions early, how does your firm view funding of redundant reserves through captive reinsurers? And additionally, what are the issues surrounding the transparency with respect to life insurer-owned captives?
I'll start from a rating agency point of view. We've said publicly that we view a financing solution as a reasonable mechanism for financing redundant reserves and managing that excess capital in an efficient manner. Having said that, they've really exploded over a decade. We estimate perhaps as much as $100 to $150 billion of reserves have been funded. The split on that is about 60% ULSG, secondary guarantee UL, and followed by term by reserves. VA is a very complicated issue, but it's relatively small by reserves in proportion to total use of captives. Now, with respect to transparency, I think Neil might have some different views. I'll just do it from a rating agency perspective. You know, when New York made a lot of noise a couple of years ago about the black box and made some noise about the lack of transparency, rating agencies, and I'll speak at least for AM Best, we get an advantage because the captive statements are voluntarily filed with us, but we keep the information proprietary. What that means is that we do not publish any of the data in those NAIC blanks, but we have full disclosure as to not only the amount of the redundancy and the financing, but the underlying collateral, and we involve management in discussions about the solutions.
Neil, I haven't forgotten about you yet, so. But please chime in.
Actually, I don't disagree with Bill. I think between the rating agencies and the companies that were engaged in these reserve financing transactions, I think there was very good disclosure at that level. The difficulty we saw as we were engaged and started talking to different regulators is that no regulator knew what any other regulator was doing, and no company knew what any other company was doing, and that secrecy fed the rumor market and the rumor mill like crazy. There were some states that weren't allowing any captive finance transactions. There were other states doing it in a fairly conservative way using the MOM test that Dave just talked about in Vermont. But there were other states and other companies that were using it in a much more aggressive way. But because it was secret, because no one outside of the company and its rating agency knew about what was being done, you would have companies being worried, first of all, regulators being worried that there may be solvency problems with some of the companies that were using them more aggressively. And you would have companies that would say, my competitors are getting a competitive advantage by using these finance transactions aggressively. They would go to their regulator and say, I don't really want to do a captive finance transaction. I know you don't want me to do a captive finance transaction, but if I don't do one, I'm going to be at a severe competitive disadvantage. I'm not going to be able to write business in a profitable way. I'm going to start over time either losing business or having financial difficulties that you're going to have to deal with as a regulator, so we're going to both have to swallow our pride and do a captive finance transaction. So a very significant part of what we were engaged to do was to try to make sure that there's transparency not only between the company and the rating agency, but also between the company and other among regulators and also the world at large, so that people would know exactly what's being done. And then also, as the rules were developed on how to do these transactions, enough transparency to make sure that everyone was following the rules.
Very good. My next question is for Bill and Alan to start off. How do you evaluate the financial risks of life insurer-owned captives? And then are all life insured AXXX and XXX captive solutions viewed equally?
I'll start the show. Bear in mind when you cede the reserves to a captive, it's not reinsurance is in the terms of getting off the hook. You're not ceding risk. It's a financing mechanism. You know, if mortality goes significantly south in excess of the reserves, someone has to make the policyholder whole. And so, you know, that it could be a third party providing an LOC. Some states even allow for economic type reserving. Arizona is sort of a modified gap view, which means you're holding lower reserves in the captive, but in none of these transactions are you passing risk off.
I was going to answer the question from a different perspective. As I interpreted the question, it was how do rating agencies evaluate the risk of the financial risks of the insurance companies that they rate ceding risk to captives? And that same question is, do they view all life insurer captive solutions equally? And the answer is, each of the major rating agencies has their own proprietary approach for how they evaluate captives. Now, each of them has disclosed to some degree what they do, but they each do their own thing. And I think it's fair to say with regard to overall how they evaluate insurance companies in general, they each have their own algorithms. As Bill said, they each want to truly understand the nature of each transaction and reflect that appropriately in their risk evaluation process. They likewise reach some different conclusions about the relative advantages and disadvantages of different forms of transactions. I'll say that they each attempt to do what they think is sort of a combination of balancing accuracy with simplicity, and so that they can't look at every scenario of, if there are 10,000 stochastic scenarios, they can't, they have to find an efficient way to utilize their time, but they each use an approach that they think is appropriate. My experience has been that regulators also, in the approval process, both captive regulators as well as ceding company regulators, have expressed different views as far as what forms of financing they're comfortable approving and what forms they're not. And regulators that do approve these kinds of transactions don't all agree on which forms to approve.
The view of the rating agencies, no, they're not viewed equally. There are various levels of collateral that is used. There's recourse, non-recourse LOCs. More recently, we see parental guarantees just being used as the collateral, which we feel is the weakest form of financing a reserve, because it's just what pocket are you going to take the money from? The other thing is that because we have full access to the captives, when we look at the risks, we also look at the capitalization, and we're able to take the captives and put it back together with the primary company and take a look at capital ratios, our own proprietary formula, and apply it as if the captive was never formed. So that's how we get a holistic view of the risk and the capital that's deployed.
It's interesting, you said, what's it going to look like if the captive was never formed? And we would often ask that question of what, when a seeding company came in and talked about a captive, what's this look like if you take the captive out of the picture? And the usual answer would be, you really can't compare that, because if we weren't doing a captive, we'd be doing something else. When you said that, it occurred to me. But when we're looking at the financial risk of a captive, from our perspective, we want to make sure that if the seeding company is on the hook, as you said, the primary company is first responsible. We want to make sure that if it does get to that point of reaching into that financing layer, that one, whoever's providing the financing is sound, and two, there's no way they can get out of it. So our review focused on both, are you a financially sound financial institution or a reinsurance company, whatever kind of company you are, do you have the assets to back up your promise here? And two, making sure that the conditions, if any, were such that what we always try to get was to the conditions of no conditions. Not unconditional, but the only conditions they now call a prioritized letter of credit or priority financing. The letter of credit or the financing doesn't kick in until the captive has exhausted its normal assets, which is going to happen anyhow, because nobody's going to want to draw on the letter of credit when you've got a couple million dollars in the bank. You spend your cash first, but that was put into the contracts. We're the last, the captive's the last money on the table, or the financing is the last money on the table, but it's there. We check on the solvency of the financing company and make sure that there's no way for them to get out of it.
Thank you. Neil, discuss the development of your report related to captive reinsurance on AXXX and how you arrived at your recommendations, and how does this compare to what David just kind of referred to?
When we were engaged, we started interviewing companies, we started interviewing regulators, started reading the materials that were out there, including the white paper, trying to get a sense as to what people were concerned about. It really came down to two fundamental things. The first was everybody was doing something different, and because it was secret, no one knew exactly what anybody was doing, and everyone was afraid someone was doing something perhaps even far worse than what they were doing. So at its simplest, our recommendations are to say everybody approach this problem the same way. So let's say if $1 billion is ceded to a captive, everyone who allowed reserve financing transactions was using some sort of an actuarial method to try to determine what portion of that $1 billion needed to be backed by more traditional assets and what portion of the $1 billion could be backed by less traditional assets. But everyone was using a different method. So in some states, some transactions, $300 million might be backed by traditional assets and $700 million by softer assets, and some it was 50-50, and some the 70-30 was there, but percentages were reversed. It just was all over the board. So the first thing we tried to do was to come up with a measuring stick to make that calculation so that everyone would use the same general approach as to how much needed to be backed by traditional assets and how much could be financed. And that was based off of after lots of discussion, lots of consideration of other alternatives, principle-based reserving methodology was what was chosen as the way to make that dividing line. So if the $1 billion reserve under current statutory is there, and let's say 700 million is what PBR would be, then the uniform national standard would be you've got to back 700 million with more traditional assets, and the 300 million can be financed. The second part of it, of the national uniformity, was getting everyone to agree on what kinds of assets could be used to back, or must be used to back the 700 million, and what kinds of assets could be allowed to back the 300 million. And that just a division that's called primary security and other security. There's very specific definitions of what fits within primary security. But under that hypothetical, the uniform rule that everyone now has to follow is the 700 million has to be backed by what's called primary security, and the other 300 million is eligible to be financed, and it's purely at the discretion of the company and its domiciliary regulator as to whether to finance that remaining 300 million.
Thank you, Neil. And you may have touched on it already a little bit, but perhaps if you could comment a little bit more on some of the things noted by AM Best and how do the recommendations in your report address the solvency issues of life insurer-owned AXXX and XXX captives?
Well, actually, the approach when we were first engaged, the discussion all centered around captive regulation. You know, the concern was jurisdiction X does a really great job of regulating captives, but jurisdiction Y does a really poor job of regulating captives. In jurisdiction Z, we have no clue as to how they regulate captives. So there was a strong concern to say, develop uniform standards for captive regulation. So it kind of started down that path, but after a short period of time, I started realizing that's really not, I think, the way we should go. And so we ended up focusing instead on the regulation of the ceding company. And the reason for that is when John and Jane Doe buy an insurance policy, they buy it from Company X. Company X might retain that business, Company X might cede it off to a captive, Company X might cede it off to a traditional insurance or reinsurance company, they might do some other way. And it's important what happens out there behind the curtain, but what's really important is that Company X has to have enough assets to pay John and Jane Doe when the policy comes due. So what we kept saying is, instead of focusing on the secondary issue of how the captive regulation is going to be, let's focus on making sure that Company X has enough money to pay John and Jane Doe. So the requirements basically said that the ceding company, the company that has the contractual relationship with John and Jane Doe, has to hold. It can't just segregate in some ephemeral sort of way. It has to hold either on a funds withheld or trust basis. It has to have money that it holds or is available to it, primary assets up to that PBR level. So that way, even if the captive regulation isn't done in the best way in the world, even if the captive fails, at least the ceding company, the company that owes the Does the money, is going to have the money to do it. The second reason we kept focusing on the ceding insurer regulation rather than the captive solvency is because there's no way that we in the U.S. could ever come up with a regulatory scheme that would be applicable to all captive jurisdictions, no matter where they're located. So even if we came up with the perfect captive regulation solution and said, if every captive regulator did this, we'd be in, you know, hog heaven, that couldn't be imposed on any jurisdiction outside the U.S. And so anyone who wanted to circumvent the rules would move their captive from Vermont or the other jurisdictions that Dr. Hoyt mentioned to an offshore jurisdiction. There's no way those rules would apply to them. And we thought that didn't make any sense at all. I mean, you'd mentioned I'm part of the accreditation program, and I've been to, you know, Dave State, I've been to a lot of the states that do captive regulation, and I would much rather have the captives domiciled in those states and with Dave and his colleagues than being offshore. And so we kept thinking, well, let's focus on the ceding company rather than focus on regulation of the captive. And by doing that, we don't have to worry so much about whether captives are solvent. We just have to make sure that the ceding company's got the money to be able to pay the Does when the claim comes due.
Thank you, Neil. And just for the record, I think hog heaven is an actuarial term?
It's actually, we thought about incorporating an AG 48, but I think it's going to wait for the regulation instead.
Thank you. Thanks for that clarification. Dave and Alan, have you seen any changes in how captives are formed with respect now to AG 48?
I'll go ahead. Right now, no. Things have slowed down a little bit, but generally AG 48 just changes that line between perceived economic and perceived excess reserves and doesn't really change the structure of the transactions yet. We've already required additional disclosure and filing with the NAIC, so it didn't, at least in Vermont, didn't change anything other than where you draw that line.
I was going to say hog heather is more of a Midwestern term than an actuarial term, but on the East Coast, we don't see too much of that, but in the Northeast, I should say. I would give
Dr.
a different
Hoyt
answer.
Dr. Hoyt captive started in Ohio, so hog heaven's appropriate.
I would give a different answer than Dave with regard to structure. I agree. I mean, the key issue is that for the new structures that are being pursued right now that satisfy AG 48 requirements for covered policies is that they need to ensure the satisfaction of the required level of primary security. And so there are some new features that are being built in to make sure, sort of belt and suspenders, to make sure that they absolutely satisfy that, because the regulatory framework that Neil designed has some penalties, serious penalties, for the seeding company if there's a shortfall. And so they want to make extra sure that that primary security requirement is satisfied. The other interesting thing is that the calculation of that required level of primary security, it's the actuarial method reserve, often abbreviated as the AMR in AG 48, and that reserve is a lot more complicated to calculate than the best estimate economic reserves that were in most of the transactions that have been executed since 2003. So there was an extensive amount of work, actuarial work really, to try to build models and test models and validate them to make sure that they were accurately calculating this reserve. And that reserve is more volatile than the economic reserve, so sometimes there's some additional features built into the transactions in order to address that volatility and try to balance the concerns of the financing provider with those of the insurer.
We, when the guideline came out, which was effective only for new business and at the beginning of the year, certainly we engaged companies immediately, and what are your plans to comply with the captive rules? And are you going to finance new business? And the answer was pretty uniform. One, we're studying it. Two, we're trying to get our arms around the actuarial piece of it. And three, which is less clear, is they continue to work behind the scenes with their regulators on exactly what would and would not constitute primary securities. I think the jury is still out on what that will be, although if you read the reg, it's pretty straightforward. It says securities, but as you know, when a rule comes out, companies try to get the most cost-efficient way of meeting those rules. So to date, we haven't seen any meaningful activity, but that might be poised to change as we get into the new year.
When Alan described all the actuarial processes that have changed, it's like the actuary will tell you how to draw the line. We just told you the line moved, is the difference between an actuary and an accountant. But I'll have to put this back up and say, from a Vermont perspective, things haven't changed because we always required what would qualify as primary assets up to that line. So that nothing changed from our perspective. It was always funds withheld or cash or investments, no change in that regard.